Propaganda by Edward Bernays. Chapter 11. The final chapter. The mechanics of propaganda. The media by which special pleaders transmit their messages to the public through propaganda include all means by which people today transmit their ideas to one another. There is no means of human communication which may not also be a means of deliberate propaganda, because propaganda is simply the establishing of reciprocal understanding between an individual and a group. The important part to the propagandist is that the relative value of the various instruments of propaganda and their relation to the masses are constantly changing. If he's to get full reach for his message, he must take advantage of these shifts of value the instant they occur. 50 years ago, the public meeting was a propaganda instrument par excellence. Today, it is difficult to get more than a handful of people to attend a public meeting unless extraordinary attractions are part of the programme. The automobile takes them away from home. The radio keeps them in the home. The successive daily editions of the newspaper bring information to them in office or subway, and also they're sick of the ballyhoo of the rally. Instead, there are numerous other media of communication, some new, others old, but so transformed that they become virtually new. The newspaper, of course, remains always a primary medium of the transmission of opinions and ideas, in other words, for propaganda. It was not many years ago that newspaper editors resented what they called the use of the news columns for propaganda purposes. Some editors would even kill a good story if they imagined its publication might benefit anyone. This point of view is now largely abandoned. Today, the leading editorial officers take the view that the real criterion governing the publication or non-publication of matter which comes to the desk is its news value. The newspaper cannot assume, nor is it its function to assume, the responsibility of guaranteeing that what it publishes will not work out to somebody's interest. There is hardly a single item in any daily paper, the publication of which does not, or might not, profit or injure somebody. That is the nature of news. What the newspaper does strive for is that the news which it publishes shall be accurate and, since it must select from the mass of news material available, that it shall be of interest and importance to large groups of its readers. In its editorial columns, the newspaper is a personality, commenting upon things and events from its individual point of view. But in its news columns, the typical modern American newspaper attempts to reproduce, with due regard to news interest, the outstanding events and opinions of the day. It does not ask whether a given item is propaganda or not. What is important is that it be news. And in the selection of news, the editor is usually entirely independent. In the New York Times, to take an outstanding example, news is printed because of its news value and for no other reason. The Times editors determine with complete independence what is and what is not news. They brook no censorship. They are not influenced by any external pressure, nor swayed by any values of expediency or opportunism. The conscientious editor on every newspaper realizes that his obligation to the public is news. The fact of its accomplishment makes it news. If the Public Relations Council can breathe the breath of life into an idea and make it take its place amongst other ideas and events, it will receive the public attention it merits. There can be no question of his contaminating news at its source. He creates some of the day's events, which must compete in the editorial office with other events. Often the events which he creates may be specially acceptable to the newspaper's public, and he may create them with that public in mind. If the important things of life today consist of transatlantic radio phone talks arranged by commercial telephone companies, if they consist of inventions that will be commercially advantageous to the men who market them, if they consist of Henry Fords with epoch-making cars, then all this is news. The so-called flow of propaganda into the newspaper offices of the country may, simply at the editor's discretion, find its way into the wastebasket. The source of the news offered to the editor should always be clearly stated and the facts accurately presented. The situation of the magazines at the present moment, from the propagandist's point of view, is different from that of the daily newspaper. The average magazine assumes no obligation, as the newspaper does, to reflect the current news. It selects its material deliberately, in accordance with a continuous policy. It is not, like the newspaper, an organ of public opinion, but tends rather to become a propagandist organ, propagandizing for a particular idea, whether it be good housekeeping, or smart apparel, or beauty in home decoration, or debunking public opinion, or general enlightenment, or liberalism, or amusement. One magazine may aim to sell health, another English gardens, another fashionable menswear, another Nietzschean philosophy. In all departments in which the various magazines specialise, the Public Relations Council may play an important part, for he may, because of his clients' interest, assist them to create the events which further their propaganda. A bank, in order to emphasise the importance of its women's department, may arrange to supply a leading woman's magazine with a series of articles and advice in investments written by the woman expert in charge of this department. The women's magazine, in turn, will utilise this new feature as a means of building additional prestige and circulation. The lecture, once a powerful means of influencing public opinion, has changed its value. The lecture itself may be only a symbol, a ceremony. Its importance, for propaganda purposes, lies in the fact that it was delivered. Professor so-and-so expounding an epoch-making invention may speak to 500 persons, or only 50. His lecture, if it is important, will be broadcast. Reports of it will appear in the newspapers. Discussion will be stimulated. The real value of the lecture from the propaganda point of view is in its repercussion to the general public. The radio is, at present, one of the most important tools of the propagandist. Its future development is uncertain. It may compete with the newspaper as an advertising medium. Its ability to reach millions of persons simultaneously naturally appeals to the advertiser. And since the average advertiser has a limited appropriation for advertising, money spent on the radio will tend to be withdrawn from the newspaper. To what extent is the publisher alive to this new phenomenon? It is bound to come close to American journalism and publishing. Newspapers have recognised the advertising potentialities of the companies that manufacture radio apparatus and of radio stores, large and small, and newspapers have accorded to the radio in their news and feature columns an importance relative to the increasing attention given by the public to radio. At the same time, certain newspapers have bought radio stations and linked them up with their news and entertainment distribution facilities, supplying these two features over the air to the public. It is possible that newspaper chains will sell schedules of advertising space on the air and on paper. Newspaper chains will possibly contract with advertisers for circulation on paper and over the air. There are, at present, publishers who sell space in the air and in their columns, but they regard the two as separate ventures. Large groups, political, racial, sectarian, economic or professional, are tending to control stations to propagandise their points of view. Or is it conceivable that America may adopt the English licensing system under which the listener, instead of the advertiser, pays? Whether the present system is changed, the advertiser and propagandist must necessarily adapt himself to it. Whether in the future airspace will be sold openly as such, or whether the message will reach the public in the form of straight entertainment and news, or as special programmes for particular groups, the propagandist must be prepared to meet the conditions and utilise them. The American motion picture is the greatest unconscious carrier of propaganda in the world today. It is a great distributor for ideas and opinions. The motion picture can standardize the ideas and habits of a nation. Because pictures are made to meet market demands, they reflect, emphasize, and even exaggerate broad popular tendencies rather than stimulate new ideas and opinions. The motion picture avails itself only of ideas and facts which are in vogue. As the newspaper seeks to purvey news, it seeks to purvey entertainment. Another instrument of propaganda is the personality. Has the device of the exploited personality been pushed too far? President Coolidge, photographed on his vacation in full Indian regalia in company with full-blooded chiefs, was the climax of a greatly overreported vacation. Obviously, a public personality can be made absurd by misuse of the very mechanism which helped create it. Yet, the vivid dramatization of personality will always remain one of the functions of the Public Relations Council. The public instinctively demands a personality to typify a conspicuous corporation or enterprise. There is a story that a great financier discharged a partner because he had divorced his wife. "But what," asked the partner, "have my private affairs to do with the banking business?" "If you're not capable of managing your own wife," was the reply, "the people will certainly believe that you are not capable of managing their money." The propagandist must treat personality as he would treat any other objective fact within his province. A personality may create circumstances, as Lindbergh created goodwill between the United States and Mexico. Events may create a personality, as the Cuban War created the political figure of Roosevelt. It's often difficult to say which creates the other. Once a public figure has decided what ends he wishes to achieve, he must regard himself objectively and present an outward picture of himself which is consistent with his real character and his aims. There are a multitude of other avenues of approach to the public mind, some old, some new, as television. No attempt will be made to discuss each one separately. The school may disseminate information concerning scientific facts. The fact that a commercial concern may eventually profit from a widespread understanding of its activities because of this does not condemn the dissemination of such information, provided that the subject merits study on the part of the students. If a baking corporation contributes pictures and charts to a school to show how bread is made, these propaganda activities, if they are accurate and candid, are in no way reprehensible, provided the school authorities accept or reject such offers carefully on their educational merits. It may be that a new product will be announced to the public by means of a motion picture of a parade taking place 1,000 miles away, or the manufacturer of a new jitney airplane may personally appear and speak in a million homes through radio and television. The man who would most effectively transmit his message to the public must be alert to make use of all the means of propaganda. Undoubtedly, the public is becoming aware of the methods which are being used to mould its opinions and habits. If the public is better informed about the process of its own life, it will be so much the more receptive to reasonable appeals to its own interests. No matter how sophisticated, how cynical the public may become about publicity methods, it must respond to the basic appeals, because it will always need food, crave amusement, long for beauty, and respond to leadership. If the public becomes more intelligent in its commercial demands, commercial firms will meet the new standards. If it becomes weary of the old methods used to persuade it to accept a given idea or commodity, its leaders will present their appeals more intelligently. Propaganda will never die out. Intelligent men must realize that propaganda is the modern instrument by which they can fight for productive ends and help to bring order out of chaos. The end. And now some further information about the author, Edward Bernays. Edward Bernays was born November 22, 1891, and died on March 9, 1995, and is regarded by many as the father of public relations, although some people believe that title should be shared with other early PR practitioners, such as Ivy Lee. Born in Vienna, Bernays was both a blood nephew and a nephew-in-law to Sigmund Freud, the father of psychoanalysis, and Bernays's public relations efforts helped popularise Freud's theories in the United States. Bernays also pioneered the PR industry's use of psychology and other social sciences to design its public persuasion campaigns. Quote, "If we understand the mechanism and motives of the group mind, is it not possible to control and regiment the masses according to our will without their knowing it? The recent practice of propaganda has proved that it is possible, at least up to a certain point and within certain limits." End quote. He called this scientific technique of opinion moulding the engineering of consent. One of Bernays's favourite techniques for manipulating public opinion was the indirect use of third-party authorities to plead for his clients' causes. Quote, "If you can influence the leaders, either with or without their conscious cooperation, you automatically influence the group which they sway," he said. In order to promote sales of bacon, for example, he conducted a survey of physicians and reported their recommendation that people eat hearty breakfasts. He sent the results of the survey to 5,000 physicians, along with publicity touting bacon and eggs as a hearty breakfast. Bernays drew upon his uncle Freud's psychoanalytic ideas for the benefit of commerce in order to promote, by indirection, commodities as diverse as cigarettes, soap, and books. Bernays's clients included President Calvin Coolidge, Procter & Gamble, CBS, the United Fruit Company, the American Tobacco Company, General Electric, Dodge Motors, and the fluoridationists of the Public Health Service. Beyond his contributions to these famous and powerful clients, Bernays revolutionized public relations by combining traditional press agencies with the techniques of psychology and sociology to create what one writer has called the science of ballyhoo. PR industry historian Scott Cutlip describes Bernays as perhaps public relations' most fabulous and fascinating individual, a man who was bright, articulate to excess, and most of all, an innovative thinker and philosopher of his vocation that was in its infancy when he opened his office in New York in June 1919. Much of Bernays's reputation today stems from his persistent public relations campaign to build his own reputation as America's number one publicist. During his active years, many of his peers in the industry were offended by Bernays's continuous self-promotion. According to Cutlip, Bernays was a brilliant person who had a spectacular career, but, to use an old-fashioned word, he was a braggart. When a person would first meet Bernays, says Cutlip, it would not be long until Uncle Sigmund would be brought into the conversation. His relationship with Freud was always in the forefront of his thinking and his counselling. According to Erwin Ross, another writer, Bernays liked to think of himself as a kind of psychoanalyst to troubled corporations. In the early 1920s, Bernays arranged for the US publication of an English language translation of Freud's General Introduction to Psychoanalysis. In addition to publicising Freud's ideas, Bernays used his association with Freud to establish his own reputation as a thinker and theorist, a reputation that was further enhanced when Bernays authored several landmark texts of his own, most notably Crystallizing Public Opinion from 1923, Propaganda, which you've just heard, from 1928, and The Engineering of Consent in Annals of the American Academy of Political and Social Science, March 1947. Bernays taught the first public relations course in New York University in 1923. Bernays defined the profession of Council on Public Relations as a practicing social scientist whose competence is like that of the industrial engineer, the management engineer, or the investment counsel in their respective fields. To assist clients, PR counsellors used understanding of the behavioural sciences and applying them, sociology, social psychology, anthropology, history, etc. In Propaganda, his most important book, Bernays argued that the scientific manipulation of public opinion was necessary to overcome chaos and conflict in society. Bernays's celebration of propaganda helped define public relations, but it did not win the industry many friends. In a letter to President Franklin D. Roosevelt, Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter described Bernays and Ivy Lee as professional poisoners of the public mind, exploiters of foolishness, fanaticism, and self-interest. And history showed the flaw in Bernays's identification of the manipulation of the masses as a natural and necessary feature of a democratic society. The fascist rise to power in Germany demonstrated that propaganda could be used to subvert democracy as easily as it could be used to resolve conflict. In his autobiography, titled Biography of an Idea, Bernays recalls a dinner at his home in 1933 where Karl von Weygard, foreign correspondent of the Hearst newspapers, an old hand at interpreting Europe and just returned from Germany, was telling us about Goebbels and his propaganda plans to consolidate Nazi power. Goebbels had shown Weygard his propaganda library, the best Weygard had ever seen. Goebbels was using my book, Crystallizing Public Opinion, as a basis for his destructive campaign against the Jews of Germany. This shocked me. Obviously, the attack on the Jews of Germany was no emotional outburst of the Nazis, but a deliberate, planned campaign. It is impossible to fundamentally grasp the social, political, economic, and cultural developments of the past 100 years without some understanding of Bernays and his professional heirs in the public relations industry. As a result, his legacy remains a highly contested one. As evidenced by a recent BBC documentary, PR is a 20th century phenomenon, and Bernays, widely eulogised as the father of public relations at the time of his death in 1995, played a major role in defining the industry's philosophy and methods. Bernays once engineered a pancake breakfast with vaudevillians for the icy Calvin Coolidge in what is widely considered one of the first overt media acts for a president. Bernays is held in high regard by some and thoroughly despised by others even today, and was even named as one of the 1,000 most influential people of all time. In addition to his uncle Freud, Bernays also used the theories of Ivan Pavlov. So there's more about the man who set about developing and actually using propaganda, what we today call PR and advertising. And you are being manipulated and controlled by that propaganda and that advertising, whether you know it or not. And hopefully, after listening to this audiobook and finding out more about the man who wrote it, you've got a better idea of how you are influenced and changed and manipulated by the system, by the media, by governments, and by society, whether you like it or not. Thank you for taking the time to listen to this audiobook, and I hope you found it interesting. My name's Alan Taylor Shearer for Radio Free UK.org.